Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Lumieres podcast with me, Jodie White. Today, guys, we are going to talk about death because, let's face it, as a culture, as a society, we really need to. Despite being kind of an intrinsic part of being alive, it is something that happens to everyone. We really don't like to talk about it, and our medical system will do anything it can to prevent it happening, despite the wishes of sometimes of the patients themselves. When did you last hear a friend tell you they'd been working on their will or that they'd chosen a song they'd like to be played at the ceremonial commemoration of their life? How do you feel about your dying? How about those close to you dying? Do you have a plan for your death? It's time we got these conversations going publicly. As I'm sure you've noticed, death is in the air right now, with so much talk about coronavirus death tolls, some people saying the rates have been overinflated, some people saying they've deliberately been underreported and that the real count is much higher. It's hard to know who to believe, but either way, as a society, we're still incredibly frightened of this part of life, and understandably so. By its very nature, we can know nothing of what actually happens. But depending on your belief system, we can have a pretty good guess, and that seems to be enough for most people. For myself, coming within a hair's breadth of dying at a very young age reframed my life as nothing less than a blessed gift. It was a second chance to be here, which I'm forever grateful for. And I think there's a lot of peace to be found in coming to terms with our dying and the deaths of others. After all, it's the fundamental nature of life. All things will end. And there's a lot of wisdom there. How can this truth teach us to live more fully while we're able to? I've noticed more conversations around death awareness popping up in the media recently. Russell Brand's been talking on his podcast to Amanda Palmer. I noticed a previous guest of mine, Manda Scott, has a new episode of her Accidental Gods project out, and she's talking about death awareness. And I think it's such an important topic, especially at this time. There's never a comfortable moment to talk about this stuff, but you know, it's still kind of taboo, really. Most people would not initiate a conversation about death. In fact, they'll do everything they can to not be involved in it. But I think it's essential. It's really important that we have this awareness about how fragile life is, but also understanding that that can be a teacher, that can be a gift, that can bring us more fully into being alive. So here is a contribution to the Cauldron of Death Awareness from myself and my guest today, Sophia Campbell. Sophia is a basket maker and a weaver of coffins and other homewares. She primarily uses willow. Her own encounters with death have come in a very personal way, with the passing of her mother and her sister. And as you'll hear, it was actually through her grieving process after her mum died that she began working with baskets and weaving. And what I love about Sophia is that she really brings a depth of feeling and an open heart to all she does. And it's really apparent when you meet her and you see the work that she does. And I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. So I just want to say thank you again, Sophia, for your time and energy. If you'd like to look at her work, find out more, she has a website, and that is all the W's, wovenfarewell.co.uk. And you can also find her on Instagram, and that is at wovenfarewellcoffins. And they really are beautiful, beautiful coffins, the most beautiful I've seen. So please do go and follow Sophia and support her work where you can. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing to the podcast or sharing the link with your friends. You can also drop me a line if you like at hello@lumierespodcast.com or use the contact form on the website. On Instagram, it is at lumierespodcast. And if you use Facebook and you'd like to follow the release of new episodes, it is facebook.com/lumierespodcast. Okay, people, that's it from me. Thanks for listening. Until the next time, breathe deep and go well.
So, my name's Sophia. I live in Herefordshire. I am a willow coffin maker and a willow basket maker. I've been making coffins for about just over a year now, and I've been working with baskets and other willow products for about 7 or 8 years. I initially got into basketry when my mum passed away about 8 years ago. She was a good friend of someone in my hometown who was a well-known basket maker. And this lady gave me a load of willow and space in her workshop. And I had a load of time on my hands and stuff to process. And basketry is one of those amazing things, like a lot of work with your hands, where you just focused on the technical, and it really allows space because there's a lot of presence that's commanded from focusing on technique. So that was really important for my mental health at the time. And since then, it's sort of been a something I do on the sidelines, and recently I've just decided to focus on it a bit more, and yeah, it's a real privilege.
Have you always done creative? Have you always had a creative practice, like growing up, or?
Well, my father is a composer, and we have kind of artist vocations in my family, I suppose. But I didn't have a particular art practice per se. What we did do as a family was we were very immersed in nature, and my mum was an avid ecologist, and both my parents are environmental activists of different kinds, or my mum was. So working with natural materials has always been a big part of my upbringing, and yeah, my kind of curiosity. So that's, I suppose that's a bigger influence on why I work with willow. And then I suppose my philosophy on death has also come about through my mother. With her passing, the way that she died in such a, it sounds funny, but such a beautiful way, very kind of engaged and in relationship with her dying process, but also the people around her, enabled me to kind of sort of face the darkness of it head on, and that kind of dispelled a bit of fear, so I'm able to work in the funeral industry now. So yeah, my mum has been a big influence on many different aspects of how I am now.
So it was kind of, I guess it sounds like it was a healing, you started out weaving as a healing thing rather than a kind of just, oh, I fancy doing some creative crafting or something.
Yeah, you're right. It was, I was interested before that, and I've always been interested in kind of practical future-proofing, developing skills that will be necessary in times that may be less stable than now. But I it was very much a kind of a healing, spacious process for me in my bereavement.
What materials are you, so you, what you mentioned willow, what is it, mostly willow that you work with, or?
Almost completely willow. There's various different bits of timber that I use for the coffins, the slats that go lengthways along the base and the lid, and then the nameplates. But it's mostly willow that's produced in Somerset, willow with the bark stripped off and then the bark kept on.
Is there a reason why willow is the kind of the basket maker's material of choice, or?
Well, in the UK there's history of oak and also hazel and a bit of chestnut. That's more in France. I suppose willow is so much faster growing, and because it's a lot more supple, it doesn't require so much processing. Whereas with, I'm not an expert in the other materials, but you know, you have to steam some of them and strip them down in which are a bit more intensive.
I remember I was on a well, I was on a kind of solo meditation retreat once. I just went to this little cottage in the woods, and for some reason I decided to try and make a basket out of brambles. While I was there.
And I went out. You strip the thorns off?
It was winter, and I went out and collected, I had a YouTube video that I was following, and I just went out every day and collected loads of brambles, and spent ages stripping them off, and then ages doing the thing. And I think it took me like a few hours a day for the whole week to get something that was like vaguely a basket. But it was incredibly rewarding process, because it's so, it really focuses you and helps you slow down, right? And
sure.
Yeah, yeah. I really noticed the meditative qualities of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
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 Do you find it kind of has a, when you're just working on your projects, do you find it has a, how do you find that? Can you talk more about how it makes you feel, maybe?
Yeah, well, working with Willow does have a real meditative influence on me. I actually choose to listen to meditation talks sometimes when I get bored of the radio. So that's great, because I'm one of those people who just finds it quite hard to sit still.
Yeah.
And meditation's always been a priority in my life, but it's when I can, ironically, when I'm keeping myself busy doing other things, then I can use it as an excuse to listen to meditations and talks. So there's that aspect. But yeah, also just the real focusing on how each piece of Willow is responding and being really attentive to its subtlety, and it's a big part in a form of meditation. And then there's another layer on top of that, which is when I'm making coffin, especially when I know the person or I've seen a photo.
How did you get into making coffins? Like, where did that start?
Well, that started from my mum, in how she influenced my approach and familiarity with death. And then when my sister was killed, unfortunately, a couple of years ago, it was just like, life is too short not to do what you're passionate about, not to do what you feel called towards.
Mm.
It's too short not to not to dispel the inner critics that hold us back from what we feel drawn and magnetized to in life.
Mm.
And so I had a lot of more time on my hands because my daughter was born around the same time, and those two things catalyzed and propelled me into working with death more explicitly. And it also, that, you know, because of the culture we live in, the material culture, there isn't so much respect for lasting objects like those made out of willow. Those that take more time to make. And when you can buy a wicker basket from China for like £2, you're not going to pay 30, 40 quid for the same thing. So coffins, there is more of a market for them at the moment, willow coffins.
Right.
A lot of the big, all the big basket makers in the UK, they're mostly making coffins nowadays.
Wow. Okay, yeah. So that's that side of the creative industry is booming.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there are more people. I guess there's a whole lot of factors that are playing into that, with the kind of environmental consciousness and people looking into natural burial and that kind of stuff. And
and also a real spaciousness for people in the UK, at least, to have a bit more of a DIY funeral. In other parts of Europe, in continental Europe, there's a lot more control. The funeral industry's really controlled by a small amount of people. And the UK, because of a lot of campaigning that's happened over the last 30 or 40 years, there's more awareness that you can of people's rights. And we're starting to see that in the last 5 years, where so not only can you have a willow coffin, that willow coffins are the most popular alternative to veneer coffins, but you can have them with loads of different pictures. You don't even have to have a funeral director. You can be buried in your back garden.
Oh, can you?
Yeah. Yeah, there's loads of crazy things that people just have no idea about.
You're not going to get in trouble for doing stuff like this.
Because,
I mean, I would have thought there was loads of, not knowing, I would have thought there was loads of legalities and various things. And I remember seeing there was a one-man play. I don't know if you've seen it. Part Viking, I think he was called. The guy did this. It was based on a story of his friend who died, and then they had they got the body, they broke the body out of a morgue and took it up to took it up to somewhere and basically put it, gave a Viking burial with a burning, on a burning kind of raft.
He
got in loads of trouble.
This
whole play was about his adventure doing this with a couple of his friends as to kind of send off this one of his close friends.
He actually did that.
I think he actually did it. I mean, it wasn't clear whether he was how much of it was true or not, but it seems like he actually did it.
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want people to go off and bury their loved ones in the garden. I mean, you need to probably apply for permission from your local council. You definitely need to make sure that the loved one isn't being buried within a certain distance from a footpath and a watercourse.
Okay.
But apart from that, you really can bury anyone anywhere. You can't have your own funeral pyre. Mm. They are still illegal in the UK.
Right, okay.
So there's a real kind of expansion of alternative funeral practices in the UK, and ownership and power towards the individual and away from big business.
Are there many people doing this now? You said most basket makers that are doing this will be working with coffins.
There are a lot of people making Rilla coffins. There's probably three big companies based in Somerset. That's the traditional willow weaving area of the UK.
Right.
Somerset being the settlers of the summer, because in the winter it used to be underwater before it was drained for agriculture.
Yeah.
And I think there's around 15 small scale willow coffin makers in the UK who make between sort of two a week to one a month.
Wow.
And I'm in between that. So there's really only a small amount of us, and it is a growing area. I suppose what I do that's different to most people is I'm one of the only coffin makers in the UK that gives a proportion of their profit to charity.
And so I
chose to do this to kind of really concrete my relationship with the life, death, life cycle. And I give some of my income to the Woodland Trust.
Okay, yeah.
To, you know, conserve and preserve semi-ancient woodland, which I think has a lot of poetry to it. There's many different types. There's someone in Cornwall making coffins out of bamboo that they're growing in Cornwall, which is a first, which is really cool.
Interesting.
Yeah, bamboo coffins are, again, quite popular, but they come from China.
Okay, not something you associate with the wilds of the UK.
No, or Cornwall in particular. Yeah, so it's an exciting time.
And so when you're making it, what's the process when you're making a coffin? Like, they're all made to measure, I imagine. Could you talk us through like what the process is when you get someone phones you up and says, well, sure, we'd like to move forward with this. How do you?
Well, it depends what their timeline is. Some people need a coffin for next week, and others have a bit more time. So the willow without the bark on, the buff willow, is a matter of hours to soak. But the willow with the bark on is about 8 days, 9 days in cold weather. So that will determine the coffin they want. I do have stock, so it's not so much of a reactive business in that sense. But if someone... So I have three set sizes.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I don't always make them made to measure.
Okay, yeah.
If somebody wants to come and get involved in making a coffin for their loved one, then I do make to measure.
That must be really powerful.
That's definitely the most rewarding part of this business. It's another level, really, because you're not only are you enabling somebody to have, again, more ownership and involvement over their bereavement process, which has proven to have a more integrated
Grieving process.
Weaving weaving a coffin or being involved in the funeral helps the brain process the loss and the soul. So that's a really incredible thing. And, you know, people bring along photographs and they get to talk to me about their loved ones. So it requires a certain amount of holding and emotional boundaries. But it's incredibly beautiful. And I've only so far, I've only had one person come to weave their own coffin, which was really special. Yeah, an amazing woman in her 80s who just retired as a yoga teacher. So she was really fit and wasn't ill. Full of life force still, and really, really special. I didn't want her to go. But yeah,
So she's planning ahead.
She was planning ahead, yeah. But you get all these things. You've probably heard about coffin clubs.
No.
Or maybe some of the listeners will. They're amazing. They started in Australia, and there's a big one in Hastings in Sussex. Where people get together and they, over the course of about 6 weeks, they make their own coffin with a group of each other, through which is cardboard, and then they paint or collage images onto their coffin. So being involved in your own funeral process is very small, but it's definitely
on the rise. Is this people who are intending to use them? Just like as a kind of practice for death awareness? Because I can see that being useful as a... You know, as to sort of just take some of the taboo out of the death discussion, as it were.
And to take some of the gems out of facing your own mortality. That is such an important learning curve. I don't know if people do that going along to the coffin clubs, but I wouldn't be surprised. It's mostly older people. Who are kind of thinking a lot more about their funeral. But yeah, big way to boost the taboo of and the fear of talking about your own funeral with your loved ones. Something that I suppose seems quite separate to me, being in my early 30s. Even though I could die tomorrow, or this afternoon, it's still pretty abstract.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Our culture with death, I think people generally find it a distraction to think about, or uncomfortable distraction, maybe, that we're finite beings, we're not going to just be here forever, and you never know what's going to happen tomorrow or later. Sure. You know, it's there's a lot of wisdom in the approach of living as if, you know, you never know when you might die.
I think
that awareness, and it comes through, some people get it in quite extreme circumstances, near-death experiences. But just the act of going to it could be really valuable in a group space, so there's a bit of support for that, and everyone's in the same boat, and it's kind of like, we all know that we're going to be there one day, so having steps to approach that, to just, so we're a little bit more comfortable with it. How do you find dealing with like the families of the bereaved and families?
I suppose I don't have so much.
Is it a direct, or do you work through an agency, or do you work directly with people who order from you?
At the moment, I just work direct with the public. I'm about to approach local funeral directors, who'd be my agent, I suppose.
Yeah.
In this context, and it is quite a delicate fine line about, again, emotional boundaries and how much, you know, if people are just in the early stages of, in the shock of grief, being a professional person, I don't want to ask too much, but also I'm not a completely cold, separate person. So, you know, if, like, for example, I had someone earlier call me up to ask about coffin, and bless him, he burst into tears as we were talking, and I'm really honoured that he could do that to a complete stranger, being me. So, you know, I was quite empathetic, but I I didn't try
you don't want it to turn into a counselling session kind of thing.
Didn't try and therapise him.
Yeah.
Because I don't meet the families, unless they come and wee with me, I don't meet them in person. There is a natural kind of boundary there.
Mm.
I always feel quite moved when people, whether or not they get emotional on the phone, I still feel really moved.
It's kind of an honour, right? What you're doing for them is such a personal, intimate thing.
Yeah.
To kind of send somebody off on their sort of their physical body burial into the earth through a creation of your own.
Yeah.
That's like it's a
big deal.
Yeah.
It feels quite immense sometimes, actually. And then I have to, step back and remember I'm just doing, it's just a day-to-day livelihood. It's a bit like, I think that there are so many parallels between birth and death in that kind of completely normal and everyday and at the same time absolutely profound.
yeah. Like it, millions of people, it happens to everyone every day. But at the same time, everyone's unique, everyone's experience and understanding of it's going to be different. And
I do something that's kind of in the early stages at the moment, which I'm quite excited about expanding, which is death meditations with my coffins.
Mm.
So people that I've only sort of trialed it at festivals and, I'll be bringing it to kind of local community centres in the future. So it's half an hour and I have bring people into the space and kind of introduce them as though it's their funeral when they're lying in the coffin. They can have the lid open or closed because for some it may be too much. And then read to them various readings and meditations on impermanence and mortality. And I've had a few people who are ill with terminal diseases and, people come as couples, so they're mother and father and daughter, or, it's really big stuff. And that, I think, is going back to what you were saying about lessons with mortality, and
it's so important boosting, though, I think, that kind of thing. I think there's such a need for things like that in communities, especially in our culture where we're a bit death phobic.
A bit.
Understatement. It sounds, that just sounds really transformative potentially, that work. So I could see that. I mean, it'd be amazing if you could go to different communities and see and have that experience, and people were just, it was as regular as a meditation circle or something, as common.
Yeah,
that would be amazing. Have you heard of the idea of the Death Lodge?
No.
So this kind of, I think I was reading about it in a indigenous kind of culture where they when somebody's dying or kind of in their approaching their dying, they take up a death lodge where they stay. There's a purpose-built lodge and they sort of occupy this, and then people come from the community to say their goodbyes and to interact, and it's kind of like an honoring of that person's life before they pass.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many interesting rituals, and I think there's a lot to learn from people around the world who approach death in a way that's more, I was going to say alive, but more.
Yeah,
more,
that would be fitting.
Yeah, just more incorporating it into it's a key part of being alive. It's like everyone's going to go through this. I think the more people can feel comfortable talking about it and kind of approaching it with each other, and the better the health of the culture, really.
Definitely. It's really interesting when we look at the parallels between the environmental situation we're in and the Western culture's relationship with finite. And you were saying earlier about, we don't think of ourselves as mortal. We think of things continuing on as they are, and and we don't think about the end of the cycle. And I really think there's a strong correlation between our lack of relationship and respect for the elderly people, for death, and for the effects that our experiences in the world will have environmentally. I do think there's a lot of very interesting exploration to happen there.
Yeah, the experience of just being in a coffin and having that sort of sense of one day this might be where my body's going to end up, as a reality, as a stark reality, rather than just putting it off, not really thinking about it. So interesting. I remember one of the most powerful ceremony experiences I once had was a burial. There was a couple actually, but one particular was you go out in the morning and dig a grave in the earth, dig your own grave, spending a few hours doing it, and then spend the rest of the day buried, telling the story of all your memories from the first memory to the last memory until that morning that you went out, kind of telling your story to the earth, giving your life away, and then having the experience of lying in this grave that you've dug, having told the story of all of your experiences up to that point. It was incredibly powerful. I wonder if there are things like the workshops that you're talking about could be a way to just touch that kind of awareness and maybe bring it back into our society, where we are scared of talking about these things.
Very much so.
You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but how does your personal experience of death feed into the work that you are doing with the coffins? So imagine that must be having had people close to you pass, and the work you're doing is obviously very aligned with impermanence. And how do you have any strategies for managing that, and how do you approach that?
Well, I suppose I still have a bit of fair amount of unprocessed grief around my sister, who died a couple of years ago. So if I am not on it, and I'm talking to people around about death and their bereavement a lot, then I do get quite sad about Anna, in a way that's it doesn't have the right sort of container. So I suppose I shut off a bit emotionally, but I think that's quite healthy.
Yeah.
Really. I think it's most of the time it just helps me be more present with myself, my relationships, in particular my relationship with my partner, not sweating the small stuff, you know, just feeling really grateful. Actually, interestingly, gratitude and love can really come hand in hand with bereavement, if the awareness is right and there's enough support for the bereaved person. In my experience anyway, the more intense the grief is, the more the over time the gratitude and then the loving support can come through. So in little drips and trickles, my secondhand experience of grief and bereavement does allow me to feel gratitude in a way that I in turn am quite grateful for. But I do, I suppose that a spiritual aspect, if you can call it spiritual, is a big part of why I was drawn to working with death in the first place. That sense of more than me, interpersonal.
Have you got any desire to to expand on that in the future, or, you know, like, do you feel drawn to work with dying people, or is this kind of, this is like a place you feel quite comfortable in with the coffin work?
I suppose it depends on my capacity, but I do feel really drawn to studying to be what's called a death doula.
I was going to mention that because it feels like, I don't know, it feels like the sort of thing that you've been, I don't want to say trained for, but there's a lot of experiences you've had that have sort of put you on a path. Perhaps.
Yeah. No, you're right. Death doulas, I think, are becoming more and more important, and, you know, coming back to being important, because the village, the respected elder, whether that was the village doctor or the priest or you know, the midwife, or they were the death doulas, or the I suppose in other cultures the medicine people, and it is a real honor. There's a few people I've been around when they're very close to death, and there's this beautiful kind of transparency to life that comes about, this kind of parting of curtains, you know, thinning of the veil between this life and the beyond, but also thinning of the, in Buddhism you'd call it delusions, or, you know, that mind fog that comes with unuseful ego. And I think I'd be really honoured to do that. Actually, my partner and I are planning on setting up a natural burial ground in the next 5 years.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, so that I probably creating a beautiful biodiversity haven for people to come and be buried and remember their loved ones, those who aren't being buried there, will, in combination with coffins, probably be enough death focus for my partner. He hasn't had the same life experiences as me, so he's sort of would be at saturation point with that, aside from the doulaing. But yeah, no, I'd love to be a death doula. I sense that I will be a lot older and wiser at the point that I want to do that in practical terms.
Have you heard of the maybe it's something you do, but have you heard of the thing where they plant a tree, or there's the seed of a tree? Is a tree planted in the with the burial at the same time as the burial, and then the tree grows, you know, above the person that's been buried?
That's a form of woodland burial,
is it?
I think.
Okay.
I mean, there's lots of different ways to do it.
Right.
But that's a beautiful metaphor, that planting a tree over someone's grave.
And then there's a tree then that people can go to and it, in some way, maybe it's part of their loved one who's gone, because it's been fed by them, which I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. What I'd love to do is create a little fruit orchard
in
some of the natural burial ground.
A fruit orchard.
Yeah. So people would be
an apple from grandma. Yeah.
Grandma's essence.
Wow.
In the apple, then you take it away, make a pie.
I love that idea. Yeah. That's amazing.
I don't know. I floated it by my partner and he thought it was a bit too weird. But I think it's poetry, isn't it?
Yeah. If you had a natural burial ground or a space where that was happening, you could offer that as an option. You know, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially if it becomes a memorial place. Yeah. I don't know if it was where you'd envisage people could come and return to to sort of remember or just as a burial site. But I love the idea of that. Burial forest garden.
Yeah, like, I think so. I think it's great. It's a great use of space as well.
And imagine the way you could teach about the cycles of life and death to kids with that scenario.
Definitely.
There's so much potential for these things.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's really exciting. And again, you know, going back to the unknown position of the future, I don't know if we're going to be able to afford to have plots of land that are just dedicated to burials, I think they're going to need to be multifunctional and have very food growing point. And a bit like golf courses. I really hope, sorry if anyone's playing golf who's listening to this, but I really hope that golf courses don't exist in the near or far future, because it's just...
It's a massive waste of space.
Yeah, it's quite hilarious almost. So, apple trees... eat your loved one's nutrients. And I think that's kind of going to be our focus for the long term, really.
Yeah. What you're saying about the current sort of overdue heightened awareness of, in the mainstream of climate crisis and the ecology of the planet at the moment, I think it feels a lot of people are very scared. Because it's forcing them to confront dying and their death in a way that maybe they don't want to or would rather not think about for a while. But this idea that, you know, people, groups like Extinction Rebellion, it's all in the, it's in the name, Extinction. Like it's forcing you to confront the fact that, you know, the planet and the human impact on the planet is way out of balance and has been for a long time. It feels to me that this can only be a positive thing, and the more that people are able to connect with their death and appreciate and understand the processes from a young age, I'd say as well, you know, it's like, it's amazing, a friend recently, their one of their dogs died, pet dogs, and they've got young kids, and it's such a, I mean, pets is one way, I guess, for kids to really appreciate and start to understand that people, that things don't live forever. I think it was the same for me maybe as a kid when my dog died and we buried her in the garden, and it's kind of, but it's, I think it needs to be a lot more than that. It needs to be in communities, these kind of practices that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Have you got any plans to take that workshop around this summer to places, or are you?
Well, I've been asked to take it to a Buddhist festival called Buddhafield, so I'll be there. At the moment, I'm just focusing on building up the business more, just kind of getting it really stable, because, like I said, I've only been doing it for just over a year. It's exciting times. I suppose with going back to you talking about how the situation of the world and nature and ecology links to being in more relationship with our own mortality, I think it's also there's a lot of unprocessed and people trying to process grief around extinction of non-human species,
because
that's a lot more easier to get someone to get your head around. And so I do feel like working through that will lead to focusing on the shadow of lots of other areas of our mind and eventually our mortality. But it's still very niche. It's still very small scale, but it's almost like an immune response. It feels like we can't not turn towards this. It's like being magnetized towards it.
Long overdue.
No, and it does feel like a really good thing, just sitting with things that are uncomfortable, developing and rediscovering skills around being with what's uncomfortable in ourselves. I think is is one of the few positive things about the situation of the world, and
No, that was I totally agree with you 100%. If for some reason we have to go through this to get people to open up experience, go through a bit more of an awakening of understanding of this, of these things, then I don't know, it's a sad way to go, but at the same time, if it helps evolve you know, life on this planet, humans included, then...
Yeah. Well, we're hardwired not to think about our mortality.
Mm.
And although we're hardwired to have a negativity bias, to just always be thinking, okay, what's the threat here? What's gonna, you know, how can I survive this situation? We are hardwired to not think about our own death. So it's really interesting kind of consciously overriding and consciously changing the neuron pathways in our brain.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is not easy.
Definitely. And this seems to be, there's a theme developing for the past couple of episodes with neuroplasticity and changing the way the brain works and changing the way you think. And it's all very possible. It's all very possible.
Yeah.
I can't agree more with that. Do you have any kind of personal practices that help you just stay grounded and stay kind of like you were talking about before, this sort of emotional distance? And how do you keep that for yourself?
Well, Buddhism's a big part of my life.
Okay, what kind of Buddhism?
Insight Buddhism, Vipassana.
Uh-huh.
Not Goenka. There's a centre in Devon called Gaia House, which I go to a lot. There's a lot of, you know, loads of stuff online nowadays, and so I listen to that while I'm weaving, but also when I'm going to sleep, and just thinking about impermanence in a way that's completely integrated in my moment to moment world is really crucial. And it's something that I've got a 2-year-old daughter, and if that's the only thing that I impart on her, I'd just be really chuffed. the impermanence is always there, and it's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a safe thing.
Yeah. And it's the nature of things.
It's the nature of things, literally. Yeah. How about you?
To deal with mortality or to look at mortality, I guess... I feel I'm probably in a bit of a different situation than many people, having had a near-death experience as a teenager. But what I do remember about that was how calm I felt at the time, which was very, looking back, it was kind of a bit odd.
Mm.
Something that's so crazy and so sort of, not like the whole time, but obviously initially it's a massive shock and there's all sorts of things going on, but... throughout the treatment I had, I was very calm. I seem to remember feeling very kind of weirdly accepting about a lot of it. And you hear it a lot with people who've had near-death experiences, that they, when they realise they're about to die, there's like this, or they could die. There may be an imminent thing. There's almost a peace that comes with it and a deep sense of acceptance and...
Mm.
I think that you could see that reflected in the stories of like prey predator relationships, where a lion's just grabbed a gazelle or something, and he's just, rather than struggle, the gazelle just goes, oh, okay, and it just kind of goes, all right, you got me, and I'm going, and it's kind of there's a peace, there's almost an accepting letting go of the struggle there, which I think is really key, because a lot of people do struggle at the end of their lives, and it's a lot of people do have difficult deaths. And I think the medical system sort of plays into that, really, when they're just trying to prolong life as much as possible, even when people don't want to die. Do want to die. There's like an impetus that we have to try everything and pump them full of everything to keep them alive as long as possible, despite their wishes and despite their and so I think there's definitely something to be shifted around the individual's needs and you know, respecting the wishes of somebody. I mean, the assisted dying thing is controversial, but I mean, I think in certain scenarios, it's so it's so the individual's choice, really. Like, and to take that away from them and just keep prolonging their life when they don't want to leave? I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me.
No.
Especially in terminal cases where people are just like, you know what? I'm good to go. Like,
yeah, I'm ready.
Yeah. And I think we have a big problem with that.
Yeah. But the hospice movement has been amazing in the last 30, 40 years in allowing more focus on care of the dying.
Mm.
There's a woman called Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. You may have heard of her.
Know the name, but yeah.
She's an incredible woman. She's got a few books. So there is that has been a real gift in the UK and America and other Western cultures, sort of reversing this kind of strange relationship we've had with death.
Mm.
And with dying, and you know, at all costs stopping people dying, even though it's in our nature to die.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like an anti-nature approach, really.
Yeah.
Stephen Jenkinson talks a lot about this stuff. I think he had a book about called Dying Wise, which was, I saw him do a talk once. It was really eye-opening about all this kind of pushing past the conditioning of the way we are about death.
Mm. He lived with Native Canadian First Nation people.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a powerhouse.
Yeah, he is a powerhouse. I've heard him on some podcasts, and you do not mess.
No, you don't.
He's not wasting any time. Nope. He's just going to tell it straight. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's another thing, you know, about people who've had, because he was a palliative care worker for a long time, I think, and that's where a lot of his kind of learnings and things came from as well. And people who've spent a lot of time around death or dying people tend to, they don't mess around. No. They know words count, time counts, what you do with your day counts.
Yeah.
It's like the old kind of shamanic saying about living as if death is just over your shoulder.
Mm.
Maybe it's in a Castaneda book or something, but there's this idea of living, you know, as if death's just like walking one step behind you.
Mm.
And I really like that.
I really like that.
I really
well.
Like that. It just makes really loads of sense to me.
Yeah.
Oh. I think that's partly what I carried after my illness, was just this idea of like every day is an amazing opportunity to be grateful to just be here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then what you do with it is up to you, but it does count. And yeah.
Philip Pullman hits the nail on the head with his trilogy. Where you get the death, your own death, and there's always accompanying you. They're like your little friend. And they're just such a... I listened to the the recordings recently, and they're just such little friendly beings. I just love that, and it's so mainstream.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's just dripping into people's unconscious about the death. Death is a friendly being that's always with you. You can have a relationship with it.
I don't know if you've seen... is it Disney DreamWorks or something? The Coco, film about Day of the Dead in Mexico, which I think is such a. I mean, that's another really great way of using story to get through to kids and to adults, I guess, because they've got a totally different relationship to death in Mexico and a lot of those Latin countries. Like, it's very much part of life. They even have Santa Muerte, and they worship and talk to this kind of figure of death, and there's whole churches you can go to that are like the saint of the church is death, you know. And their mashup of like witchcraft and Catholicism is insane. You know, I remember going to, once traveling in Mexico, I went to a church in the south where it was a Catholic church, and there was paintings of, you know, Mary and Jesus all around the world, walls and different saints and things. And then down at the front, there was a man sacrificing a chicken in a bag with a bottle of Coke and some incense with the vicar in a Catholic church.
Wow. And
the relationship that they had to death is completely different. And the celebratory kind of aspect when people pass. And I think the last couple of years, me and my partner have got this tradition now where we sort of do it ourselves, and we make a little altar, and we get like the photos out and some offerings to the ancestors.
Your chicken.
Yeah.
Tell me you sacrifice a chicken as well.
I don't do any sacrificing of chickens, no, if you're wondering.
So, your incense and
but
photos.
Just like, yeah, I mean, taking, I mean, I don't think that's cultural appropriation. I think that's a healthy ceremony that can be cross-cultural. To practice a remembrance day where we just, you know, remember the dead and honor the dead and what their lives meant to us and all this kind of stuff. I think that's really, really necessary and really, really healthy. And
and there's a long tradition of it happening in the British Isles and
Samhain.
So there's no cultural appropriation there. I suppose we can take inspiration from current practices that are still very strong, but no, it's great. Remembrance and ancestors are just absolutely vital to a healthy sense of self and cultural self.
But we don't get taught that, really.
No.
I mean, it's like grandma and granddad. Beyond that, it's like we don't... I mean, there's definitely a... You can see there's a resurgence of interest in this stuff in the collective with the rise of programs like Who Do You Think You Are and people tracing their ancestry from a kind of mental mind perspective, understanding where they came from.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of, it's not grounded I don't know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's definitely making people think more about death and ancestry and the people, their bloodlines and stuff like that.
There's a lot more baby boomers. We have got the baby boomer generation that are quite old now. So I think that's got a lot to answer for with the resurgence of focus on ancestry and lineage and history.
Oh, it's been fascinating talking to you, Sophia. Thank you so much for your time today.
No, it's been fun. It's been really interesting. Thank you.
For people who want to just see what you're doing and learn more about the coffins and the basketry and look at any workshops you're doing, do you have social media links or a website?
Yeah, I've got Instagram, Facebook and website. I suppose you'll post the links on...
What's your handle just for...
What's the handle?
The name of your Instagram and
my coffin business is called Woven Farewell and Instagram is Sophia Campbell Basketry. If you want to see what I'm doing, that's the best place to go.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. We found our way.